Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, March 16, 2022. I'm Ash Bennington. It's Fed Day. The FOMC has pulled the trigger, hiking the Fed funds rate 25 basis points. We're joined by someone who follows all of this very closely, Darius Dale, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. But first, let's take a quick look at what's happening in U.S. equity markets on this Fed Day. Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1.55% up to 34,063 here at the end of the day. S&P 500 settling at the close of the session at around 4,358. That's up approximately 2.25%. NASDAQ, big winner on the day, up 3.77%, closing out today's trading at 13,436. Russell 2000 also up on the day, about 2.5 percentage points, closing out the day at 2019. And we could not have a better guest here on Fed Day than Darius Dale. We know you're watching it closely. Darius, welcome.
Ash, what's up, man? It's great to be back. How you doing?
It's great to have you back. By the way, Darius, you don't know this yet, but you are on the 2-year anniversary show for Real Vision Daily Briefing. So not just Fed Day, an exciting day to have you here.
I'm blessed to be here, man. Thanks for having me. It's awesome. Let's get right into it.
Let's do it, man. What's happening? What's going on? What's your take on this Fed Day?
Yeah, so Powell did a really remarkable job, in my opinion, of walking the tightrope that is appeasing the sort of faction of the political spectrum and the factor of the investor spectrum that wants them to do get really serious on inflation and doing what it takes to restore price stability, to borrow their phrase. But they also said enough about in terms of talking up the economy and really sort of kind of assuaging some of the concerns around growth in a near-term recession, in order to sort of remove what I would consider to be, at least temporarily, a hawkish right tail from policy. And so as you can see, obviously, asset markets are generally behaving positively as a response. If you look at where, for instance, the S&P was prior to the prior to 2 p.m., prior to the statement, you know, we're up about 30, 40 points, S&P points higher than that. Bitcoin's up about $300 or $400. Higher than that. So there was a positive response in asset markets. And partially, it has a lot less to do with what Powell said, but what Powell didn't say. What Powell didn't say was that, hey, look, we're going to have to slow this economy and take and drive up the unemployment rate in order to get price stability. What he said was, you know, we're, and obviously they did this, their summary of economic projections as well. But what he said is, no, we're going to actually stick the landing here, which is very rare for the Federal Reserve in any policy tightening cycle.
All right, Darius, let me play devil's advocate on this. Here's the point. What did you expect him to say? We're going to get inflation down, but we're going to crash the economy. I mean, doesn't he have to sort of sound positive and say, look, we're going to work on the price stability side of the ledger to try and control this inflation at 40-year highs? And by the way, we're going to aim for a soft landing. We don't want to impair labor markets. What were his other options?
There is no other option, right? The Fed is not allowed to forecast recession, but the yield curve can. As we saw with the yield curve, continued to flatten on the meeting. We had 2s, 10s, was about 30 basis points prior to the statement, and came in at 25 basis points at the close of his press conference. He had 5s, 30s at 33 basis points, at 28 basis points by the time Powell stopped speaking. So the market is looking forward ahead, and you also have 30-year bond yields. You know, so we had to start to see a little bit of a divergence between, you know, the 2s, 5s, 10s, 2s, 5s, 7s, and 10s relative to 30s. 30s actually down 2 basis points relative to where they were prior to the statement. So the market is looking ahead and sort of taking Powell's word for it in pockets of the market. But right now, as it relates to risk assets, and this is something we're definitely going to have to unpack, you know, we're heading into OPEX on Friday. And OPEX, typically what happens in OPEX is that...
Darius, explain what OPEX is for those who don't know.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, let me take a step back. We're heading into options expiry on Friday, particularly for stocks and indices like the S&P 500. And as a function of the sort of all the kind of in the money puts that are sort of about to expire, dealers are starting to pull back on those hedges. So when you buy a put on the S&P 500 as an investor, what happens is the dealer who sold you that put has to turn around and delta hedge that exposure by shorting the underlying. Well, as we get closer and closer in OPEX, they can reverse those hedges because obviously theta and things of that nature, and also about the decline in volatility itself, are all dynamics and factors that are creating, you know, sort of this sort of positive lift into the market. And so what's likely to happen, and so what's likely to happen from here is that in the absence of anything really negative happening out of Russia and Ukraine, the markets are probably likely to trade positively into and through OPEX. The issue is what happens next week when we'll be in a situation whereby 30% or thereabouts, somewhere around a third, according to Spot Gamma, of all the sort of put exposure out there is likely to expire. All the gamma put exposure is likely to expire on Friday. And so investors will be kind of left with this really awkward choice, which is, did Powell say enough to not spook me into rushing to put those hedges back on? Or is there enough of a sort of negative macro market environment out there that investors will have to sort of reach for more protection? And we would tend to believe that the latter is more favorable, latter is more probable.
Right. By the way, for those who didn't follow all of that, Darius is talking here about the options positioning, how dealers basically have to gamma and delta hedge their books to come out flat so that they're not picking up additional risk exposure to these markets. And that can impact and cause some mechanical changes in terms of price action. Is that roughly right, Darius?
100%. 100%. Yeah, we're in this window of time where, you know, the decline in volatility. In fact, Brian, if you don't mind putting this chart up, we have a chart called crowding versus dispersion. And the left chart is the one I'm speaking to specifically. Or we're tracking, you know, sort of deviations in skew relative to the volatility risk premium across certain assets. And, you know, one thing we call out is that, you know, upon refreshing that analysis, during Powell's press conference, it's pretty clear that equities and risk assets in particular are running out of some of this, the sort of juice that's sort of supplied by some of these supportive flows. If you look at U.S. equities, we have about 30 or 40 U.S. equity ETFs in the sample. On a median basis, the volatility risk premium there is at minus 11% in terms of how we calculate it. And same thing with risk assets. We have about 30 to 40 or 40 to 50 risk assets in the sample. On a median basis, it's also minus 11%. And so what that means is that you don't have this sort of healthy degree of overvaluation and puts in volatility in the volatility markets that can perpetuate, you know, some very positive VANA flows beyond this sort of OPEX cycle. And so that means we need to start seeing fundamental improvement in order to put in a durable bottom in the market. And according to our analysis, we're not there yet.
So VANA is D Vega, D spot. This is the delta with regard to volatility. Yep. I think that's right. Did I get that right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The change in underlying or change in delta relative to changes in volatility.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So Darius, obviously a lot there talking about the option side of this market and also the macro component, which you touched on earlier. You said something that was really important and I wanted to double click on it. Brian, if we could take a look at the chart of the 2s-10 spread for a 1-year time horizon, I think this is a really interesting chart because it shows the flattening that had already been in the curve. That's a chart going back to March of 2021. And as you can see by looking at the screen, it's one that you could ski down.
Ski. If you tried to ski down that, you're gonna break something.
it's a double diamond.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a whatever the hardest ski. I think that a double diamond sounds about right to me. I'm not much of a skier.
And then I wanted to jump back actually and take a look at the 1-day chart off the 1-year chart, because this shows a little bit of just how quickly we saw the 2s-10s curve flattening. Take a look at that there. Pretty significant. Darius, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, look, the economy's headed towards below trend growth. That was our call at the beginning of the year. Or sorry, that was our call in fall of last year. We could have had the view that consensus was still kind of out to lunch. And Brian, if you don't mind putting up the chart, you know, this is one of the important charts. U.S. growth trend would be the chart, Brian, where we show, you know, sort of the trend in U.S. growth relative to consensus forecast for 22 and 23. And we continue to be
While Brian's putting that chart up, let me just connect the dots for our listeners and our viewers. So this is basically the 2-10s curve forecasting a decline in trend growth on GDP. And that's what we're seeing here on this chart.
Yeah, it's forecasting a negative economic outcome, either a recession or something, a slowdown that takes you to below trend from a growth perspective. The issue with that as it relates to risk assets and financial conditions on a prospective basis, going back to the chart, is that Bloomberg consensus, if you look at for U.S. growth in particular, is calling for 3.6% real GDP growth in this year. That's 160 basis points north of our trend rate. And mind you, this is in a year where we're having a near record fiscal contraction and projected seven interest rate hikes and some quantitative tightening. So that, in our opinion, remains a big risk to the downside for investor expectations and obviously financial markets, particularly risk assets. Last thing I'll say on all this is if you put up the chart, sort of economic versus market cycles, Brian, where we show in the blue line the OECD composite leading index time series relative to the black line, which is the S&P 500 high beta, low beta ratio, and the red line is the Bitcoin to treasury bond ratio, you know, the world has been in a cyclical slowdown since going back to the second quarter of last year. Whether you pick your economy, but Europe sort of started slowing on a trending basis in terms of leading indicators in November. But most economies, this haul at the middle of last year, have been decelerating. That deceleration is only going to accelerate. And our models have that pace of deceleration picking up to the downside, you know, kind of mid to late Q2. And so as long as we're decelerating, we're going to have a natural growth headwind to risk asset valuations, investor sentiment, positioning, and all those sort of dynamics that can actually perpetuate a durable bottom. Last thing I'll say on all this is that when we do the analysis, whether you look at the business cycle, investor positioning, we can unpack any of this if something tickles your fancy, or valuations, you know, we get to a terminal downside or something that would be a something along the lines of a Fed put in a range of 3171 on the S&P to about 3429. That's a long ways down from here.
Darius, it all tickles my fancy. I wish we had 4 hours to unpack everything you just said there. But I'm curious about your calculation of the Fed put relative to the price action on the S&P 500. I heard Jay Powell today at the press conference decline very graciously to give a forecast on the S&P, therefore maybe playing the cards close to the vest in terms of signaling where we might see concern from the Fed and then theoretically, of course, potential intervention.
Well, he didn't play them close to the vest at all. He let one slip, actually. He said financial conditions will become less supportive for various functions in the economy. I wrote that down. And so he's telling you the Fed is on the track to tighten financial conditions. And so, you know, this has been our core thesis the whole time, right? And back to...
Well, but we knew that from the dot plot. We knew that from the forecast. We knew that from the SEP. But he's declining to give you a particular dollar figure in terms of valuation of S&P where it might become a particular concern.
Well, our analysis puts it about -6% to -13% lower than where the B of A fund manager survey had it at on Monday. They had it at 36, and we're a little bit below that. I don't think there's any fair value in the stock market until you get to at least 36. But as I mentioned, you know, 3,200 to about 3,400 is probably our target zone.
Darius, and that's why we're so glad to have you here today, because you are not afraid to make a call and you're not going to play the cards close to the vest. Explain what that gap means between where we're trading right now. It looks like 4,357 on the S&P 500 in terms of valuations and how you think about it and how you come to that number for the delta between where you see that as a point of concern.
Yeah, so there's sort of a myriad of analysis, and I'll be quick. There's kind of the three main pillars of our analysis when you think about it from either the business cycle or positioning or valuations. You know, so we look at the Conference Board Labor Differential Index as a proxy for the business cycle. That's the spread between the jobs plentiful 6 months forward versus jobs not so plentiful. So that's usually a good proxy of you know, peaks and troughs in the labor market. And there have been, you know, 8 cycle peaks since the early 1960s in this indicator, with the median S&P 500 drawdown of 35%. So that's one. Positioning, if you look at household equity ownership relative to flow of funds, so the proxy of how much of your net worth is being contributed by your ownership of stocks, you know, that number is at about 30% in the most recent quarter, Q4. And there's been, you know, 19 of those peaks since, you know, mid-1940s, with a median drawdown of 22% for the stock market. And then lastly, probably the most bearish one is just valuations. And I don't need to tell anybody that stock market is still overvalued here. If you look at it on a real basis, earnings yield minus headline CPI, we're at about 3.4% negative. There have been six negative readings since the early 1960s with a median drawdown of minus 41%. And so you kind of marry those things up in terms of averages, and you're right around down 30% peak to trough, from the highs in the S&P. Now, that's just one tenet of the analysis. The other tenet of analysis is sort of looking at this from an analog perspective. We've thought, 2011, if you think about the secondary inflation impulse that we're seeing, 2018, Q4 18, if you think about sort of the Fed being, kind of on its path to tighten while the economy starting to slow and having that kind of divergence really start to perpetuate tighter financial conditions. And then lastly, if you think about the unwinding of the dot-com bubble and the sort of overvaluation, the corollaries between equity ownership and overvaluation, those are the three most kind of closely knit analogs to our current situation, although none is a perfect analog. And when you marry those things together, you get somewhere around 30% on the downside for S&P. So we're looking at this from a variety of different angles: growth, inflation, policy, valuation, positioning. And we keep coming up to this minus 30% number in terms of peak to trough data.
So I know that when you talk about minus 30%, that's a sobering phrase for people to hear. What are your catalysts? What are your time horizons? How do you see that unfolding?
Great question. Best question ever. So in terms of catalysts, because you need a catalyst, markets just don't, go down a lot or go up a lot by themselves. Usually what's happening underneath the surface is the broader economic and market cycles are sort of taking you there. And so when you think about the catalyst for a growth slowdown, typically what you need to have happen in order to see sort of the outsized negative deviations in risk assets is a sharp deceleration in growth. In fact, we backtested everything six ways to Sunday here at 42 Macro. And the reality is you do need to see what we call a minus two sigma deceleration in growth. So, i.e. the speed of the change in growth to the downside is right around a two sigma on an absolute basis relative to the trailing 3-year trend. We expect that those types of decelerations, that magnitude of change, will start to show up in the economy around mid to late Q2. And that's kind of one catalyst. There's another catalyst that we haven't spoken about, which I think is equally important as it relates to investor sentiment, which is earnings. If you think about S&P earnings, we continue to make new highs in terms of next 12-month earnings estimates. Haven't really seen much of a pullback despite what we are all seeing in the yield curve, bond market, new lows for 5s, 30s, almost new lows for 2s, 10s from a growth perspective. But if you look at earnings estimates, they haven't really moved that much. And earnings, if you look at it on a trailing 12-month basis, S&P 500 operating margins at 16%. I mean, you pull that chart back as far as the data goes, and the previous cycle peaks are all at 14%. I mean, you could very easily have an earnings recession just to get back to the prior cycle peak, which probably is not the terminal destination. So there's a lot of headwinds from a medium to long-term perspective with respect to the equity market, but obviously from a short-term perspective, with the Fed just not spooking markets with Kyle's commentary or the dot plot, there's a kind of a window for a relief rally here.
Yeah, and by the way, that's discounting any potential risks for a negative exogenous shock.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, like, I said this a couple weeks ago, the negative exogenous shock of 2022, and it's obviously there's no way anybody has any sort of crystal ball on it, but it's China starting to get aggressive with Taiwan. I mean, think about it. This is as good as an opportunity for China to sort of commit to some very aggressive policy on the geopolitical front as ever. The U.S. and NATO's hands are tied with Russia and Ukraine. Obviously, they're all the central banks' hands are tied with respect to inflation fighting and not being able to sort of protect asset markets in the event of an adverse outcome on a China-Taiwan aggression. Again, I have no clue if that's happening this year and happening in the year 2050, but certainly the conditions are there for China to make a move if they wanted to.
Yeah. By the way, I wanted to come back to something that you said. Obviously, a lot to talk about, a lot to think about, particularly with negative exogenous shocks from a China-Taiwan situation. That's kind of the ultimate black swan that's potentially hovering out there. Obviously, we hear some buzz about it in policy circles, some rumors, but right now, nothing more than rumors to substantiate. But I wanted to ask you a question, and Darius, I'm not joking when I say this, man. I mean this seriously. Let's talk about the dot plot. Let's talk about the SEP, the summary of economic projections. Like, so 3.6% on the Fed funds rate in 2024, according to the dot plot. What if anything does this mean? Like, what is the dot plot other than something that like is really good for guys like me who are financial news anchors to put up on screen and then, you know, with a deep sonorous voice and tone things that are probably never going to come to pass? Like, what's the point of even looking out to 2024? All it basically tells you is what the best case scenario of, you know, 12 individuals is.
Well, it's not, at this point, I would argue it's not even telling you that. It's kind of telling you nonsense. So, you know, let's talk about the dot plot. So they took up their numbers for 2022. The median projections to end at 1.875. That's up from 0.875. 2023 median projections to end the year at 2.75. That's up from 1.625 in December. And then lastly, 2024 in the year at 2.75. So no change year over year from 23 to 24. And that number's up from 2.125 in December. The issue with that, in my opinion, with this whole sort of summary of economic projections, is that the longer run projection for the dot plot for the median Fed funds estimate is 2.375. So they're telling you that they're going to be tighter than neutral in both 2023 and 2024. And you're not seeing that it reflected at all in their unemployment rate forecast. I mean, you look at it in 2023, they're unchanged at 3.5%, 2024 went up a gigantic 10 basis point rise in 2024 to 3.6, which, oh, by the way, both those numbers, 3.5 and 3.6, are lower than their longer run in unemployment rate projections at 4%. So we're still saying, hey, look, we're going to take monetary policy above neutral or tighter than neutral, and we're not going to get a drawdown in the labor market that takes it below sort of trend or below where kind of the natural inflation accelerating unemployment rate will get us to. So I think there's some moments, if you will, if you study this dot plot. But the reality is markets kind of care about this stuff. What markets care about is this sort of medium term kind of policy dynamic. Are rates going to go up faster than what's currently priced in over the medium term? Is the balance sheet going to expand or contract faster than what's kind of priced in over the medium term? And the reality is Powell just affirmed it on the rate side. On the balance sheet side, they punt it. But the reality is, I think he said enough, and I'll quote him, the American economy is very strong and well-conditioned to handle tighter monetary policy. We will take the necessary steps to make sure inflation does not become entrenched. And so all that means to me, if you're an investor, and I'll slow down when I say this, is that the Fed won't stop tightening until something breaks. That's as clear as day. And so it's your job as an investor to try to anticipate when that thing will break. And if you don't have an ability to anticipate when that thing will break, you can subscribe to services like mine, or you can just take your ball and go home. I think either is a reasonable choice.
Yeah. Darius, I'm very impressed with that answer about the dot plot for three reasons. Number one, first and foremost, because you managed to give the 50,000 foot big picture of everything that was happening and your takeaway from it, which is really the key to take all of this data, process it, and give a clear, simple analysis. Number two, masterful explanation of all of the underlying mechanics. But number three, the thing I'm most impressed by, I said the dot plot means almost nothing, and you said, no, it means less.
It means less, man. Now, the markets are going to trade on, look, if you look at overnight index swap, swaps forwards, or if you look at Eurodollar futures, there's already an inversion in the curve. And that inversion didn't go away if you look at it on a kind of 18 to 24 month out basis. So the markets are already pricing in a Fed that is going to slow the economy. The Fed's not going to tell you that in the dot plot. They can't, right? Because they'll spook markets and cause a sell-off. In the same way that today, I think that by him talking up the economy in the context of having so much put exposure, so much in the money put exposure, near-term delta expiring put exposure that would catalyze a big vicious rally in the absence of, you know, an incremental demand for puts. That's exactly what's happening. But the reality is he didn't say or do anything that was fundamentally bullish today. He just didn't say anything or do anything that was more fundamentally bearish than what the market was already anticipating. And that's how you get this sort of relief rally.
Hey, listen, I want to touch on something that we haven't talked about and in the press conference was touched on very little, which is what's happening with the Fed balance sheet. What's your interpretation of what this is going to look like in terms of the unwind of the balance sheet? Is it going to be a passive roll-off? Is it going to be active selling? What are your thoughts on it? How are you thinking about it? And what are you looking to for insight?
Yeah, so obviously we're going to get an update in the Fed's next meeting in late May. So we'll definitely get the update there. We'll get the update there in terms of understanding, well, okay, what's the plan? He did kind of allude to this really quickly and said, balance sheet runoff will be faster than last time. But as you know me, Ash, we've been talking about this for nearly a year now. It's not just about the Fed's balance sheet if you're thinking about the liquidity cycle with respect to a policy and asset markets. It's the Treasury General count is equally important at times in terms of directing the overall sort of, or changing the overall direction and magnitude of the liquidity revision. So that's how we calculated Fed balance sheet minus Treasury General count. Treasury General count balance goes up, Fed balance sheet goes down. We're draining liquidity in both instances. Fed balance sheet goes up, Treasury General account balance goes down, goes down. We're adding liquidity in both instances. And so, you know, when we look at that analysis, there's kind of a couple things, right? If the Treasury issues a bunch of bills and provisions itself, you know, there's about $1.5, $1.6 trillion sitting in overnight repo that's looking for a home, and that could actually make the sort of quantitative tightening process really sort of, I wouldn't say painless, because you know the net liquidity line going down is not ever painless, but it'll be make it more painless than it could be. However, if Yellen's not on board, or if the Treasury's content to doing more and to aiding the Fed's fight on inflation, because again, we're all assuming as kind of folks who've been trapped in this post GFC net liquidity dynamic, you know, since going back to, you know, again post GFC, we assume that all the policymakers care about is growth and asset markets. I would argue that's very different now. Inflation, sticky CPI at 6.5% on an annualized basis. Median CPI at 6.5% on an annualized basis. Those numbers are pretty close to all, the latter is pretty close to an all-time high. And the former is, you know, basically at a 30, 40-year high. So I think the inflation fight is much more serious. And they just don't want to say it's, they just don't want to do it all today. And so going back to your point on the balance sheet is, we don't know. Right. The answer is we don't know. But I do believe it's going to be more painful than I think investors would realize.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Let me ask you this. The last thing that I really wanted to talk about was there's been some criticism today from various voices out there, economists, particularly people who have experience on the labor economics side. Danny Blanchflower, professor at Dartmouth University, probably the person who seems to have been most passionate in his summation of this analysis, where he's talking very bearishly about the risk to labor markets. In a certain sense, Darius, taking a bit of an opposite side of the call from you, saying effectively, yes, there are challenges on both sides of the dual mandate, but in his view, the damage that's going to be sustained by labor markets, although they're very tight right now, I think 1.7 job openings for every single unemployed individual in the United States. Danny Blanchflower's concern, some other labor economists' concerns, is that when rates begin to rise, we are going to see a material impact on the labor markets from that rise. So two questions to you, Darius. First, if you could, I know you don't agree with it. I know it's not your perspective on this, but summarize that case for us. And then two, give us your opinion on how you feel about it.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with it. I probably would disagree with the timing. It's going to take some time for the effective tightening that we've already realized just as a function of, you know, forwards curves pricing, then, you know, changes to the as a function of forward guidance. We've already seen a backup in credit spreads and bond and high yield bond pricing. So we've seen some tightening hit the economy already. Financial conditions are well off the lows. Financial conditions indices, they're well off the lows. The issue is that there's a lot more tightening ahead of us. And so we're going to start to see the economy slow down. That's the first order effect, right? We're going to see the economy start to slow down again. Our view on that is kind of mid to late Q2 is where you're going to start to see that pace of deterioration pick up. And then by the end of the year, early part of next year, when we're tracking, you know, with inventories or just likely to have an inventory overhang at that point, you're likely to have a lot more tightening under the belt of the economy at that point. You could actually start to see a backup in the unemployment rate. One thing I'll show you, you know, if you, Brian, if you put up the chart, unemployment versus Fed funds, and this is something I think is kind of critically lost I think investors are kind of get it through the lens of the yield curve. But when you look at sort of where the unemployment rate is relative to kind of, you know, the beginning of any Fed funds tightening cycle, you know, that what that chart is showing you, I think the blue line is the unemployment rate. And I think the red line is the Fed funds rate. Those black dotted lines are the beginning of every Fed monetary policy tightening cycle, you know, since going back as far as we can get the data. This is the lowest the unemployment rate has ever been prior to liftoff. Or, you know, at the onset of liftoff. And so to me, I think that
meaning just, at the onset of tightening.
At the onset of the tightening cycle. And so to me, I think that what the key takeaway of that analysis is the probability of the Fed kind of making a mistake or breaking something like they traditionally always do in a policy tightening cycle is as high as it's ever been. You know, we don't have like an organic growth impulse ahead of us for the economy to absorb all this tightening and in stride. You know, we are way past the peak from a leading indicator standpoint in terms of the cyclical slowdown that we're already realizing. And this tightening is only going to add fuel to that fire.
I'm starting to feel a little optimistic, Darius, until you laid that chart on me, man.
Yeah, on bonds. On curve flattening. Yeah, sure. Depends on where you're long.
Yeah. So listen, we've covered a lot of ground here in the first 30 minutes, but I want to get some of the questions because we have a lot of them. They're coming in fast and thick. First question, this comes to us from Gren. Darius, any changes to your inflation projection given the situation in Russia and Ukraine?
No, I mean, so our we have two models that we use to forecast inflation. One is our stationary mean reversion model. That model's been pretty much in line with the Fed forecast and Bloomberg consensus forecast over the last month or so. Our downcast model, it continues to pick up, you know, a secondary inflation impulse. If you look at it, you know, we're in the disinflation camp. If you look at it, you know, particularly on a year-over-year basis, the problem is that disinflation may not come with the dissipation and inflation to momentum. You know, if you, and so, you know, as I keep saying, then year-over-year numbers don't mean anything. That what matters to inflation and it matters to the bond market right now, and ultimately it matters to the Fed, are the sequentials. And, you know, if headline CPI at 10% on a seasonally adjusted basis, that's no bueno. You know, you got, again, I mentioned median CPI and sticky CPI, trim mean CPI, core PCE inflation at 6.7% on a SAR basis. That's the highest print we've seen since July 82. Like, we're still building inflation momentum to the upside. You know, so it's regardless if those year-over-year numbers come down as a function of the base effects, if the sequential momentum numbers don't come down fast enough, you're going to have a Fed that is going to be 6 months from now still talking about tightening policy, even though financial conditions are considerably tighter. And that, in our opinion, is the big risk to markets.
Yeah. Darius, I'm seeing a bunch of questions from several different people here asking about your take on precious metals. What are your thoughts there, particularly gold?
Yeah, no, gold's got a great opportunity here ahead of it. I mean, obviously, you know, in the near term, it's kind of dealing with, you know, some of these sort of margin requirement dynamics at some of the brokers. And obviously, you know, there's some sort of speculation that some of the Russian oligarchs and folks who've had their assets frozen are probably taking to gold to secure liquidity. But longer term, I mean, the medium term and longer term outlook for gold is about as bullish as I've ever seen, certainly in my 13-year career. On the medium term side, it's very likely that real interest rates hit a lower high here. The long-term bond yields, real, you know, 10-year tip shield, 30-year tip shield, et cetera. Those things will hit a lower high and start to come down as a function of the deteriorating growth outlook. Mind you, this is half the people listening right now, and certainly more than half of Wall Street believes the economy is fine and the economy is doing well. 7% GDP last quarter. You know, we had robust consumer spending in January. They believe the economy is fine. But guess what? The economy is not going to be fine 6 months from now, 9 months from now, 12 months from now. And so real interest rates are going to likely follow that path of the economy lower. And that's likely to be positive for gold medium term. And then obviously longer term, the shenanigans that the U.S. and NATO are doing with other country central bank foreign exchange reserves is a disaster because it undermines credibility and confidence in the dollar, you know, sort of reserve system. But where that credibility and confidence is being lost for the dollar, it's being gained in other reserve assets like gold. So very bullish on gold.
Yeah, well said. By the way, talking of gold, Tony Gold has just dinged me in the comments. It is, in fact, Dartmouth College and not Dartmouth University, as I said. Switching gears here to crude, a question coming through. Actually, I want to ask that question sort of more broadly, what your thoughts are on the whipsawing that we've seen in crude. But the question from one of our viewers, this is from Ross from the exchange, and it's a question that I've actually been wondering about myself. If Saudis start pricing their crude in yuan, Chinese yuan, is this an indicator that the Saudis are moving closer to China and away from the United States? And if so, how will it impact U.S. crude pricing? So kind of a triple barrel question there.
I think it's ironically bullish. I mean, the less people need to use the dollar, the less demand there is for dollars globally. And the less demand there is for dollars globally, all things be equal with respect to dollar supply, and I would argue it's not going to be equal, removing dollar supply from the system, that you should have a lower dollar, if the plan falls in a supply strain. So I think the probability that we see higher crude as a function of that, purely as a function of a weaker dollar, is higher. Now, that's not the only thing driving global currency markets. So let's be very clear about this. I think we sort of get myopically focused at times on, interest rate spreads or, petrol this or petrol that, or all these different factors. Man, goodbye, Joe. I've been doing this for a while now. There's a million factors that impact currencies, and they all have different sort of coefficients at different intervals.
Yeah. Let me ask a question here. This one actually comes to us from Ralph Humphrey, but also something that we were talking about a little bit off camera, which was what's happening in China. You spoke about China vis-a-vis the situation geopolitically in Taiwan. This question is from Ralph Humphrey, is about what's Darius's view of China and the different equity sectors within China for the next few months? And I would actually point to the earlier point that you made about how we are seeing some intervention in equity markets in China right now.
Yeah, it definitely seems like there's a move towards intervening. So overnight, we had Vice Premier Li He, who's basically China's kind of top economic person, if you will, be the chief of the White House Council on Economics, if you will. I guess that would be the equivalent person. Effectively came out, they had the meeting, it's kind of an emergency meeting, and he effectively came out and said everything you need to say to arrest sort of the volatility in Chinese financial markets. It's effectively, look, we need growth positive policies. We need to get more regulatory relief. Particularly where, in the areas where macroprudential policy has been mostly focused, real estate obviously being the primary one. The issue is that, we have not seen the same sort of gung-ho attitude coming out of the PBOC. They didn't necessarily confirm those comments. And, when you look at things like, actually one more chart for you guys, Brian, if you put up the chart, China liquidity cycles, one thing that's sort of really important for me to watch in China is 3-month SHIBOR. And the reason we look at 3-month SHIBOR is because 80-85% of all private non-financial sector credit in China is on bank balance sheet. And so if you watch SHIBOR, you're effectively watching all of monetary policy, if you will, or at least, 85% of thereabouts. And so what typically happens, in these easing cycles in China, where the PBOC is using its medium-term lending, open market operations, or reserve requirement ratio cuts, you typically see, kind of 200 to 300 basis point declines in 3-month SHIBOR prior to a sustained impulse, positive impulse in the Chinese credit cycle, which itself leads the GDP cycle by 1 to 2 quarters. We haven't seen anything yet. And so this kind of goes into question, like maybe the commentary, the rhetorical shift in monetary policy and just policy in general in China puts a floor in Chinese assets for now. It puts a floor in Chinese growth expectations. But are you really going to get this sort of big bang easing that we all got used to going back to 2016, 2011, 2009, 2008, 2009. It's certainly not in the cards. We certainly don't see it in the data yet. And so that stuff's still ahead of us if that's going to be a catalyst for markets.
Yeah, one more thing that I wanted to hit before we go, because I think it's an important one. This clip from Pro Macro Insider Talks, March 2022. This is Raoul Powell and Julian Brigden, hosted by Harry Melandri, live as of yesterday on the Real Vision Pro tier, talking about rates and inflation. Let's take a look at the clip because it really is, in many ways, a summary of everything we've been talking about on this show.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of still thinking that the curve hasn't inverted. Mm-hmm. The monetary conditions have tightened. Growth is about to slow. The Fed are more likely to do 25 basis points, maybe another 25, and then, oh, shit, we better wait and see because the ISM is trading at 51 or 50. Or 52. Mm-hmm. And if commodity prices remain high, I think there's going to mm-hmm. be direct handouts. Whether it's tax cuts on commodities or whether it's money in the pockets in Europe to households to offset it.
Right. And that's certainly, I was going to say, that's the cost of war. Looks like it's coming in Europe.
This is the cost of war. So there is another flip side of this, which is that the central banks have to stop. They understand that this is monetary tightening. They have to get money into people's hands. And all of this starts getting resolved with the market sniffing out potentially an easing, i.e. the end of a cycle or a longer pause in a cycle. Because I don't buy the argument that any amount of rate rises will stop supply side inflation or inflation via this. And all I know is everybody I know, ordinary people, get texts from friends of mine, fucking hell, I'm in my car, you know, how much it cost me to fill up my car today, or their heat their homes, you know, that's a meaningful, massive reduction in demand.
Right.
So we need to be careful. The question is, do we go into a full larger recession or not, in which case the stock market goes lower unless the central bank balance sheet comes in? It's hard to see them use the balance sheet in the normal way because of the murkiness of what's going on.
So obviously some bearish sentiments there. But for me, this is the part of the quote that I think is most relevant. This idea that, quote, I don't buy the argument that any amount of rate rises will stop supply side inflation. This is something that we see mirrored in the comments. I'm always interested when I see people commenting, hey, what are you guys talking about, man? Things are terrible out there. I go to the supermarket. It cost me 10% as much as it did last year. I'm getting killed at the pump. There's definitely a feeling among many workers in the country right now that there is this real challenge with inflation, and mirrored by some professionals who worry about whether or not the Fed can get it under control. What are your thoughts on that more generally?
Yeah, my thoughts are the same. Powell addressed this very specifically, in my opinion. This is one of the more hawkish comments of the day when he was talking about the sort of the ratio of total job openings relative to total unemployed workers being at 1.7. That's obviously, he said, quote, that's very, very tight. It's tight to an unhealthy level. And so he followed that up by saying, we like to slow demand. Yeah. So that it's better aligned with supply. And so it's no longer about sort of, I think the last year's transitory debate, right, was the Fed saying it's transitory, it's supply. 2022 is the year where the Fed acknowledges the fact that supply has been reduced, supply curve has been inwardly shifted to the left as a function of pandemic, function of the war, function of, just a lot of, reduction in total labor supply, both domestically and globally. And so now the Fed has acknowledged that and saying, hey, look, there's a level of demand that is way too high relative to this sort of new realization, this new normal of supply from the perspective of the economy. And so they have to do what they have to do in terms of tightening financial conditions to get that better in line. And that's not a pretty thing for markets.
Darius, we're almost totally out of time, but real quick, 30 seconds, sum up, key takeaways, final points.
Yeah, I'll be quick. Short-term, medium-term, long-term. Short-term, next few weeks, it's very likely if you get any sort of ceasefire, any sort of positive developments out of Russia and Ukraine, there's likely to be a sustained relief rally. We're losing a lot of gamma exposure from the perspective of this Friday's option expiry. However, if you don't get that stuff, where you go back to, this is why the relief rallies are likely to be shorter in the absence of that headline risk, because the fundamental outlook continues to deteriorate. Every day we go forward in time from a medium and longer term perspective, we're talking about an economy that's growing slower and slower, and policy that's getting tighter and tighter. And those two dynamics in the context of where positioning and valuations are, they're just at odds. And so ultimately that process needs to be reconciled.
Darius, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, but especially on Fed Day. Great job here today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ash. Appreciate you.
Thanks again for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Maggie Lake will be here again tomorrow with Joseph Wang. Before we wrap, two quick notes. First, at 6:30 p.m. tonight, we will be doing another Real Vision Twitter Spaces. Twitter Spaces at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, where we will continue the conversation. Second, I mentioned at the top of the show, I thank Darius for being our two-year anniversary guest, but I wanted to thank everyone who's worked on this show. There are a lot of people who work on this show to give you the news that we get here today, the analysis that we get here every day on this show. And especially, I wanted to thank you, the audience, for watching us for the last 2 years. We very much appreciate it, and we look forward to joining you again in the future. Thanks for watching for the last 2 years. Thank you again.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.